I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and it is the final Stacks Book Club Day of the year, and we're wrapping up a solid 2021 season with one of my favorite books of the year, A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance by Hanif Abdurraqib. Our guest for this conversation is TV writer and creator and co-host of the podcast, Yo, Is This Racist?, Andrew T. Andrew and I talked today about the scope of this incredible book, the slippery slope of stand-up comedy, and our favorite and least favorite essays in the collection. There are no spoilers on this episode. Be sure to listen to the end of the podcast to find out what our first book club pick for 2022 will be. It's a good one. If you want more of The Stacks, you can find bonus episodes, a Discord community, our virtual book club, discounts and merch, and so much more over on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/thestacks to join The Stacks Pack. And shout out to our newest members of The Stacks Pack, Alejandra Rosales, Beth Lopes, Caitlin Cassidy, Emily Long, Lindsay Fitzpatrick, AliAggie13, Erica M., and Jeremy Wang Iverson. This is an independent podcast, which means without the support of listeners like everyone I just named and the rest of the Stacks Pack, there would be no The Stacks. So thank you all so much. And now it's time for our deep dive into Hanif Abdurraqib's essay collection, A Little Devil in America, with our guest, Andrew T. All right, everybody. I'm really excited. It is the final Stacks Book Club of the year. We are joined again by the wonderful Andrew T. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Best book, worst guest of the year. This is...
You know what? We aim to do it that way.
It's
a roller coaster. No, how dare you? Don't talk about my friend Andrew T. that way. Our book today is my favorite book of 2021, I'm pretty sure. I'm recording this at the end of November, so maybe there could be something that sneaks in. But at this point, it is A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance by Hanif Abdurraqib. I don't anticipate spoilers because it's a nonfiction essay collection, but if you haven't read the book and you don't want to know anything about it, stop listening. Come back when you finish. Andrew, we always start these episodes the same way, which is, what did you think kind of generally of the book?
I loved it. It took me longer than I think I in retrospect should have to like get what was happening. I was like very not like confused, but I just didn't understand the mechanics of it for a while. Probably, I think we talked about this probably like 50, 60 pages, honestly.
Like the first two essays, basically.
I think for me, it went a little longer.
A little longer.
I'm still confused, not like confused about what's in it, but it was like, I could tell there was it. And actually, to the spoiler warning at the top, I don't think there are any like content spoiler warnings to this, but it was like a really interesting journey for me as far as like, because you can kind of tell from just the trappings of the like the chapter titles and even the table of contents, like, and like sort of the title of the book and the subtitle, it's like you could tell there's something happening here. Mm-hmm. But I was like, God, I'm really not seeing it. As far as like the construction and like the way it was sort of put together. So that almost feels like a spoiler, because maybe to me it was like such a huge revelation once I like kind of got the way these essays were being written.
Right. Yeah, I get that. And then after you got into it, what did you think?
So that was when I realized, first of all, I needed to go back and reread up to the point where the light bulb went off. But also a thing that you had said, I believe, offline, possibly in the earlier, but maybe I probably not, is that you'd mentioned that when you were rereading it in preparation for this, you did it in conjunction with like watching some of the videos and listening to the music. And it really was like much more of a multimedia experience. That's what I did the second time around. It has really positively changed what my Spotify algorithm thinks about me in a really nice way, actually. I was like, oh, this is like much better than the like... My problem with Spotify actually is that it's almost exclusively used for work stuff. So it's like a lot of soundtracks and a lot of pop music that's like, does this go in this scene?
Got it. And now so, it thinks that you're like a smart, middle-aged, like black woman in the church.
Much smarter, much cooler. Yeah.
I feel that. I had a similar, so I read this for the first time, I think in like February or March, in anticipation of having Hanif on the podcast. And then when we decided to do it, I did a reread, and my reread I did on audio the second time. I had the same thing my first read of the book, that the first few essays, especially the like on times I forced myself to dance sections, I had no clue what Hanif was doing. Like I couldn't figure out what the thing was. And it wasn't until probably into the second or third essay that I really dropped in. I think it was about halfway through the second essay about grief and funerals that I was like, oh, I see. He's talking about the performance of grief or like the performance of whatever. And then once that went off for me, I could not get enough of this book. Like I, even now talking about it a week after finishing it, I'm like, should I read it again? I feel like I don't even remember all the brilliance in the book. And like on a sentence level, like the sentences in this book are just some of the most beautiful that I think I've read in a really long time, which I like sentences, but I'm not like horny for right. sentences. Like writers can be like crazy about that. That's not really me. But this book made me feel like I was like, oh, I love a sentence.
I am less, as far as writers go, less of a, not that I don't love, not love. I think I could safely say I don't love like sort of wordplay or like perfect prose as much as some folks do. I am definitely more of like a story and like kind of larger arc type of writer and reader. And I think also, it was the like the poetry of it that once it kicked in, it's impossible to not see. But like I really was like, because I think there's a part of me, and this is probably the bad part of my brain, especially for like not like nonfiction, but for like slightly obtuse writing, was that there was definitely a part of me that was like, treating it almost like a puzzle in the first, like what's the game of it? What are we doing here? And that is probably necessary for me, but probably the wrongest way to read this book.
Yeah.
it was just like, what am I doing? And then like letting myself like kind of like get into the prose and the like train of thought of it or the like free association and that. And then it became the other thing that was constantly nagging was just the like, how does one even write something this good?
Right.
Of it.
like I was having that, especially the second time, being like, wait a second, how is he weaving together these seeming completely, totally different, separate strands, like going from even like going from the chapter titles to the history and then like the pivot or the turn of the essay and then bringing it into the memoir and then bringing it into like a more contemporary example and then connecting that to the history. And like the way that it's actually constructed, to me, I've never seen an essay collection that is capable of doing that. I usually feel like an essay collection that's really great is like really great memoir style essays or like really great humorous essays, but it's very clear what's going on. This book is like, wait, is this memoir? Is this criticism? Is this history? Like what's happening? And it is all of those things sort of equally. So it's really none of those things. It's like this new genre, which is my new favorite genre. I've only ever read one book in this genre and this is the one, but this is the new genre.
Like, I mean, the genre seems to be, and I wonder, this makes me kind of wish, and I may still, I suppose, like I listen to the audiobook, because the genre seems to be like, this is just the smartest motherfucker you've ever been near, just talking.
Yeah.
And then like with the benefit, obviously, of like immense amounts of research, but then it's like, even just from like a writing standpoint, it's like, when does one apply the research? I guess it is just like you just have to imagine you just iterate this over and over and over again. You've kind of vomit out the smartest version of free association and then you strengthen and you research and then research leads you to other free associations that you then like it seems like he's riffing, but it's like it can't be.
No, exactly. It feels so almost conversational in the way that it bounces around, not in the writing itself. The writing feels like sort of heightened, but also conversational. But the other thing that I think is like so incredible about the writing, and I don't know if you were, if you did go back and watch any of the videos, or like listen to any of the music, but the way that Hanif is able to write music and videos and things that are not written is so spectacular. Like when I finished the Mary Clayton essay, Giving Mary Clayton Her Flowers, that one, I went and listened to Give Me Shelter approximately 100 times. I could not not listen to that song in a totally different and new way. And like I know that song and I love that song, so it wasn't a new thing for me. But like also going back and like watching the Whitney Houston performance at the Grammys and like like watching that, a thing that I again have seen many times. Like, it's just, it's crazy that someone can write the history of things that we've consumed with different senses, like with our eyes or our ears, and he can write it in a way that makes it feel alive and also new is just mind-blowing to me.
The Mary Clayton, for sure, and this maybe is simply just like the change in the point of view, but it's like it changes the way you hear that song in a way that's like so thorough. The one that I went back to like very like that I hadn't seen before, so I guess not back, was in the essay about ultimately about Soul Train. Just watching Don Cornelius do the Soul Train line, and I was like, oh my God, this is like so exactly as he describes, as Hanif describes, and it's like, oh, I would not have like thought of this. And it truly just felt like, you know, your smartest friend who like just was introducing you to something. Part of me does a little bit wonder, because I, when I started reading this, also didn't I feel like this bit me on another book that I can't remember what it was, but it was a like sort of contemporary, but not completely contemporary book. So there's a little passage just where he mentions Dave Chappelle. And there's, you know, obviously because Dave Chappelle has changed so much in recent times, it was like, it was just a little like, oh, where's this going to go? I'm trying to, it was an essay about Kanye West from like 2 or 3 years ago or something like that, where you're like, whoa. You know, oh, you don't have the benefit of now. But so once I got past the passage about Dave Chappelle, it was clear that this was being written in like super contemporary times. So I guess, which is all to say, like, there is a part of me that's like, I wonder, not that I think that this book will age poorly, but I do think there maybe is like a specific like moment of this where you're like, I get exactly mm-hmm. what you're saying. I consume Twitter and YouTube in a similar way. Because like when I looked up the Don Cornelius video, I was like, oh, this, he, not explicitly, but implicitly, I did exactly the thing that he probably did in his research. Mm-hmm. And I saw it in exactly the same way, probably on my phone or my computer in the same way. And I was like, it really felt like, oh, I was exactly in his head for a second. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that feeling will fade for readers, like as time moves on.
Yeah,
maybe not. I don't think it makes it any less good, but it did. It hit me extra hard. Like, this is perfect. I get this, or I think I get this feeling at least.
That's interesting, because I feel like the way that he protects against it being totally like of this moment is by incorporating the history, like the historical examples. Like, it's like he talks about Don Cornelius, but he ties that into the dance marathons. Yeah. And it's like, okay, Don Cornelius is in the past for us also, but whatever of these things, it's like there's a more contemporary example, there's a more historical example, and then there's his relationship to the thing. But I also feel like the Dave Chappelle part, I made a big highlighted note that I wanted to talk about this, so I'm glad you brought it up. It's in the essay about magical Negroes, and like my butthole clenched when he said Dave Chappelle, because the first time I read it, I didn't think anything of it. And then this time it was like a week or two after the whole fallout at Netflix and them being real big dicks to trans people and him being a real big dick to trans people. And I literally was like, oh, fuck, we're gonna have to talk about this on the show. Like, this sucks. I don't want to do this. Like, fuck Dave Chappelle. I don't care. I don't want to defend. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like I was just like, ugh. But by the time he gets to the end of the essay, he sort of has protected himself against all that Dave Chappelle does after, because he does mention how Dave Chappelle at one point was like transgressive in his humor and now is just like doing the same shit as the white people. Like, he's Dave Chappelle is now making the jokes that the white people were laughing too hard at.
Exactly.
But now it's his joke. But I think there's even a line, I want to read it because I like it jumped out to me, where he says, it's sort of long, so sorry everyone. He says Chappelle himself hasn't changed all that much, but the era has. The people who've craved permission from him haven't changed either. It's just that the permissions themselves have shifted. The same people who missed the message in his old jokes and laughed because it was funny to hear white people saying nigger are the people who now, like Chappelle, feel as though they are being censored from expressing the truest versions of themselves. In doing what he imagines as flying in the face of critics, Chappelle is once again confirming those who wish to be confirmed. Showing people that someone can say whatever they want, however they want, privilege and all be damned. And so for me, I was like, that little chunk there is basically saying like all of the things I said about Dave Chappelle in the past maybe were true, but Dave Chappelle is not that person anymore. And he is now the person that Dave Chappelle was protecting himself against. And so I felt like I didn't have to be like, ugh, Hanif loves Dave Chappelle, because he very clearly is like, I recognize that I'm defending this one moment of Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
But also everything that's come since, like, fuck that and fuck that guy.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate that.
And it is, I think it's clear that maybe there is going to be hindsight about what those moments in the past were. But I think, like, also, like, in a vacuum, they absolutely were, and at least we can't know who Dave Chappelle, the person, actually was now or then. I mean, now it's maybe more evident, but certainly then. But like, I think like you can talk about it in terms of blackness and what, like, I mean, the retrospect of it is very clear, I think, is that like Dave Chappelle is very fluent in talking about the perspective of a black man, a straight black man, and nothing else. Mm-hmm. And that's like, actually not like fine because of what he's sort of done with his power, but it is like reasonable. Like, you know, it's not like, it's sort of on us that we expect geniuses in one vector to be geniuses in every vector.
Right.
You know?
Right. And also like, that like, we feel like we can't call out these things.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
tough.
It's hard because it feels like, oh, you want to cancel Dave Chappelle. It's like, no one wants to cancel Dave Chappelle. People just want Dave Chappelle not to be like given a platform to be wildly transphobic, homophobic, and incite violence towards trans people. Like, make your little jokes, go off, like love to laugh, you know? If you can make me laugh, great. But like, if you're being horrible, you're being horrible.
Yeah. It's also like, what is cancel? I mean, I think the cancellation of it is also just like, I mean, now we're just speaking so broadly about culture, but it is like, he's definitely canceled for me in that I am not a fan anymore. Like, right.
Is that canceling?
Can't do anything to him.
Is not liking someone anymore considered canceling? Like, you don't have any power over Dave Chappelle's money, ability to get a job, housing, or anything. So isn't that just fandom? That's where I'm always confused. I'm like,
I think that's the reality, right? Like, that's the reality of what canceling, quote unquote, is like, I simply no longer hold, I'm not a fan. Don't hold him on a pedestal. I'm not going to consume his material. Like, I just don't like what he has to say anymore. And it's not like I have the power to, like, cancel his contracts or his bank account or, like, other people being a fan of him. It's just for me and for, I think, a lot of folks who were fans, it's like, oh, no, you were not speaking from a broad, wise place. You were speaking from a selfish place, cleverly, as, you know, a person who has experienced types of oppression, but, like, you didn't turn that experience into seeing what oppression does to other folks or broadening it. And that's normal. I won't say it's, like, fine, but that's very normal. Most people's, like, experience is selfish, and that's, like, understandable and sort of, like, okay, it's not ideal. It's not the way the world is going to not be horrible, but it is common.
Right.
And, yeah, it's just like, all right, he's certainly canceled for me, but, like, I don't know.
Right. I mean, I also just laugh at the, like, oh, they've canceled the celebrity because they don't like them anymore. And the same people who are, like, up in arms about cancel culture are obsessed with banning books and, you know, like, all that whole thing. I don't want to get
into
that.
It's the rhetoric of lies. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what are we going to further get into?
There's nothing to say.
But, yeah, so as far as, like, the – I just think it's, like, once again – a good example of, like, what this book does with, like, the past, which is, like, you can talk about the thing, you can place it in the past, and that's what he wanted to talk about, and what Hanif wanted to talk about, and it's, like, very, you know, like it or not, like, Chappelle's material on blackness in the early 2000s and its relationship to racism and whiteness is probably the best, like, illustration of so many of these things, what he did with his Comedy Central contract. Fun little side story is, so for a long time, my day job in my 20s was working at Comedy Central as a digital media producer. And my very first week on the job was the week Chappelle left that contract. And it was
a startling
and tense week for someone new on the job.
That's
it was
so
very
funny.
Like, ooh, what am I doing here?
Okay, wait, I want to talk a little bit more about this essay. This was one of the essays that really was special in my reading, the Magical Negro one. It talks about the prestige, which is the pledge, the turn, and the prestige, appear, disappear, reappear. And I wanted to ask you specifically, and this sort of has to do with comedy and writing and the Dave Chappelle stuff, which is, like, how do you navigate as a comedian and a writer the wrong people laughing? How do you evaluate who should be laughing and who shouldn't be laughing? And again, this also pertains to you as a podcaster. You do a show about racism that is a comedy show, and it's you, an Asian man, and a black or biracial, I don't know how Tani identifies. She's mixed, but I think she would say she's black woman, talking about racism. And it's like, you know that your audience has lots of people of color, but you also know your audience has lots of white people. And so, like, how do you protect, I guess, yourself or your peace of mind or your audience from who should and shouldn't be laughing?
So I think the thing, the broad version of a thing that is not super useful probably to this question is that in the instances where it's that type of topic on Yo, Is This Racist, we mostly just glide out of being comedy and talk earnestly.
Right.
So that probably isn't, like, broadly useful to most, like, comedians' experiences.
Sure.
And then the other thing that is sort of less useful is the like the main show I have written on is Mixed-ish, which is the spinoff of Black-ish, but also my showrunners really were very conscious of this and, like, I hope this is fair to say, you know, the show was very funny, but when it was a tough topic, we would get in like the racist jokes, but like almost always in the mouths of white characters, and there would be a rejoinder right away. So, mm-hmm. So I guess the answer is, and then sometimes it would simply be serious. Mm-hmm. We would just mm-hmm. like, we just got to fucking talk about this. X or Y topic. So the answer probably, which is again, not like super helpful, is sometimes it's just, you just don't go for the joke. I think it helps for me that like my sense of humor specifically is so tired of that type of racial humor mm-hmm. that I just don't go there often. Like, I don't personally find it funny, so it's not my wheelhouse. But I think the larger thing that maybe is more useful is like, even like speaking like about Dave Chappelle, it's not the crime, it's the cover up. Mm. And what would happen if I made a joke? And I, you know what? So I don't have examples off the top of my head, but I definitely have in the past said things like, out of places of ignorance on the podcast. The most likely stuff would be stuff about Native folks or stuff about trans folks mm-hmm. that like came out of my mouth, often just speaking, you know, often not even for comedy, but just like, you know, said a thing wrong perspective, whatever. Oh, and obviously about women like that, you know, I'm sure I've said things that are, you know, unintentionally misogynist, like a lot. And the real thing is, or, you know, whatever, baked in like latent misogyny, subconscious, etc. I think for me, it's that like the other part of the bit with Tawny is like, we're idiots. Yeah. We said something wrong. Absolutely. We said something wrong. I'm positive right. that was incorrect. And there's like, you know, and that a little bit has to do with sort of the ephemera of podcastiness, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. or at least our show. Like I do feel like your show is more making documents, and there is like a point in a beginning, middle, and end, and like you're making a self-contained thing that isn't like, is more evergreen than say any given episode of Yo, Is This Racist, which is like, comes across as an advice show, but it's sort of not, but right. it's like an ongoing conversation. So we're lucky in that, like, really what I think of the podcast, and this has probably somewhat to my detriment gone over into my TV writing, which is like, I never think of anything as like finished or done or the conversation, which again, doesn't quite work as well. I mean, on TV, when we're doing like 23 episodes a season of Mixed Dish, it's like you work really hard on it. You make it as good as you can get it. But it's also like there's going to be another episode. Right. That's sort of my mantra. It's like there's going to be another episode. Mm. Again, much, much easier for podcasts than TV.
Right.
But there's always going to be more words. You're always going to be able to say something. You're always going to be able to correct. You're always going to be able to change and update and grow. And that's sort of the sad thing with, to me, the underlying thing with the Chappelle, but also with sort of all people. Maybe this is just a factor of like being older and the fact, the my mantra of there's always going to be another word, always going to be another show is less true with every passing day.
Sure.
But the thing with Chappelle is like, Chappelle as an example, but all sort of like, you know, you see it many times and much more in older white comedians is like this sort of like defensiveness and preciousness mm-hmm. about the previous thing. I mean, there was also like a generation of stand-ups, I guess, like off of George Carlin that really took this like stand-ups are the new philosophers thing to heart. Like, guess
so
what?
Dumb. They're not. They're not.
And also, philosophers aren't that smart. Like... Yeah.
Also, philosophers are the new philosophers. They still exist. Yeah. They didn't go anywhere. They're still philosophizing.
It is just like people talking about their opinions with a huge amount of cultural bias and like
an ego. You know,
an ego. And so it's like, in that sense, they're definitely the new philosophers. But it's like Chappelle's like, you know, just going off his like, as of this recording, current stance on things that I'm right. And like, you know, you... like inability to listen, inability to grow. It feels like it simply must be a factor of like money and the echo chamber that you can build around yourself. But I also do think, and this actually kind of gets to a later essay as well, that stand-up comedy itself is the problem. I think like the idea that like stand-up requires this type of specific bravery. I'm not saying it's not hard. I'm not saying it's not like unfun, but like the like imagined in my opinion, the imagined crucible that stand-ups all think they go through and that builds a brotherhood. And I say brotherhood, I know there it's not purely a brotherhood, but the toxic part of it is really a brotherhood that like really like puts the medium before the message, as it were. Like right. It's like, just because you're doing fucking stand-up doesn't mean that inherent bravery creates like it's like a thin blue line. You're like, stand-ups are stand-ups, and the most important thing is like the brotherhood of the comic. And it's like, no, it's not. Right. Some of them are awful. Some of them are saying dumb, horrible things. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? And like, but yeah, it is like, you know, based off of how scary it was the first time. And they all. I've done stand-up exactly 7 times.
Wow. I've done it exactly once. I had diarrhea all day. Thank you.
Well, I was mostly doing it because we were about to do some live Yo, Is This Racist shows. So I was like, I should literally just learn how to like hold a fucking microphone in front of people.
Stand-up is hell, and it's not ever that funny. Sorry, I said it. I hate stand-up. I'm like anti-stand-up.
I hate it as well, but I also was like over it and had no ambitions to be good at it. Yeah. I literally was just like, this is just public speaking practice because I'm about to do live podcasts. And it helped that it was like I was a working comedy writer when I first tried it. So I was like, this is fucking easy. It's fine. Like, just like be confident enough. So I admittedly never felt that fear because I had no ambition in the space. So there was no actual failure and there's no actual embarrassment. It's like, I think nothing of these people. And so all of this is easy for me to say, but I'm just like, I just hate it as a medium. And like, I hate that the fear, and actually a little bit. So I liked the essay about, it's Mike called, Tyson.
Yeah, Fear and, a Crown. And it's about Mike Tyson and Bernie Mac.
Yeah. And it's like, And I also have like, I've never boxed like in a match, but I've boxed enough that I was like at the point where we were like sparring for real, right. Like where there were definitely times where I was like, okay, that fucking sucks. and I did jiu-jitsu enough. So I've done a little bit of combat sports where I'm like, what I liked about it actually was those were the times when I actually did feel fear. Mm-hmm. So the weird thing is, I think that was probably my favorite essay in the book, but also I disagree sort of fundamentally with one of the, like, half of the premise of the, like, stand-up parallel to it.
Interesting. But I wonder if part of, like, the Bernie Mac of it that he gets at is, like, the fear and the sort of, like, combativeness of what Bernie Mac brought to it had more to do with who Bernie Mac was, like where he was from, what he looked like, and that he too was sort of fighting his way into this brotherhood in this sort of bravado style way, as opposed to sort of where we see Dave Chappelle now as someone who's on the inside and acting like he's fighting for something. You know, it's the difference between actually fighting your way in as a black man into a super white guy, racist, sexist, homophobic space versus being a very successful black guy who's already been accepted and beloved by the people who are in there. I feel like there is like definitely a difference.
Yeah. I guess for me, I think the parallel between like combat sports and the stand up. Sort of regardless of what my inherent feelings about like how scary stand-up is go, it is like to me, I'm trying to remember how it's phrased in here, but the thing I took out of this essay was like a lesson that was sort of like hard earned for me in combat sports, which is that like, I guess it's basically sort of a fake it till you make it, but I always remembered it. And I, again, felt it more when I was boxing someone for the first time was like, oh, right. I'm scared of them. And what I didn't realize until I started throwing back is they're just as scared of me.
Right.
Or maybe they're not just as scared of me, but like I can do something to them as much as they can do something to me. And in fact, the more I do something to them, the less likely, until I overextend myself, which is right. probably the stage of where Dave Chappelle is. He has punched himself out thinking right. he's in the right. But up to the point, and certainly given my personality, I'm unlikely to extend past my comfort zone, right. or that far out of my comfort zone. So I will always be a person where aggression is actually going to be better than I think it is as a strategy.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what I like, what I really took to
in this essay
specifically. I was like, oh yeah, I know that feeling. And weirdly, I have never drawn those parallels. And I sort of, partially because I sort of disagree with
the
side of it, but I really got it. And I was like, yeah, I like this a lot.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to discuss the other 20 essays very quickly, I guess. We got bogged down in Dave Chappelle and I don't want to be bogged down in Dave Chappelle. So we're gonna take a break. We'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, we're back. Okay, we're not going to talk about all the essays because some of them I just don't feel like I have a lot of thoughts or feelings about. But if we skip any that you loved, please speak up for yourself and your essays. The one essay that I think that we have to talk about is the 16 Ways of Looking at Blackface. I thought that essay was so incredibly good. And I think like one of the things I'd be curious to hear you talk about as we go through this is that like I'm a Black person who studied theater, who studied criticism, who is obsessed with the critique of performance. So this book is like really in my wheelhouse as a person who created theater and performed in theater. And, you know, this show is essentially a show, a criticism show, a book criticism show. Mm-hmm. And so this book I found really interesting to think about performance as all things. And so I feel like I come to this from like a very, it's a very like on brand for me book and everything. But so I'd be curious to hear your thoughts if those things don't line up for you. Obviously, you're not a Black woman, so we can start, you know, diverging there. But
sure.
16 ways of looking at blackface. First of all, I just love that he finally said the thing that I think many Black people think, which is like blackface doesn't look like Black people at all. And Black people have such amazing, incredible skin, and white people have such horrible skin. And the fact that you're putting like black, like no depth, nothing on your skin when you're trying to imitate the people with like the most beautiful, glorious skin is just like such a fucking joke. And I love that he said it because I feel like it's something that I think about but had never verbalized. So that's that. But you probably deal with this a lot on Yo Is This Racist. Do you?
Yeah.
And like people pretending to be black online and like using dated yes. slang and bad photos. Do you ever worry that like you're getting emails from people on Yo that are like, I'm a black person and why is it racist for my white yeah. friend to say the N-word or whatever?
So I think the thing that is like, it's talked about here for sure, but just to, I guess, like sort of co-sign the general idea, but actually even relating to the theater practice of blackface is it's like the racists are not good at it.
They're not good.
Like, it's very evident. It's just very evident what's blackface and what's not. And you see it on Twitter all the time. Like, it's like, it gets sniffed out like right. immediately. And part of it, at least on Twitter, as far as that goes, is anyone racist enough to like pretend to be black to like support a conservative aim has no fluency with black folks. So right, like right. they like actually can't pull it off. So but yeah, and I guess it is just like I'm trying to think. I guess it's like on Yo Is This Racist, the other side of it is like actually I will say kind of recently, I think Tawny disagreed with me on this. Is that like, was it possibly when you
it
were
was
co-hosting
me.
We
it
disagreed
was definitely
on
me.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. I was like, I think it was probably me. We talked about blackface on my episode around Halloween.
I'm so sorry. No, okay. Yeah, I just remembered having, but the like, it's just sort of the like, give an inch, they'll take a mile of yes. it a little bit for me, which is just like, I know, it's none of the shit really, and also none of the shit really matters,
right.
but sort of the fact is like, anytime you kind of offer like an exception to white folks specifically, they'll fucking take it and abuse it. So that's why on Yo Is This Racist is just like, no, 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 never.
Right.
Like,
well, in my defense, you have to go and listen, people. But in my defense, the question was it was Halloween and a person saw a hostess at a restaurant and he thought that she was in blackface. But then when he like turned the corner, yeah. he realized that she was dressed up as the Tin Man from
Tin Man. Yes.
And so
yes,
I said,
yes.
no, that's not racist. The guy should get his eyes checked because yeah. I don't think the dressing up as the Tin Man is racist. But your point was like,
yeah.
if it looks like blackface, even if it's not supposed to be blackface, maybe it is blackface.
Yeah. I think that, but that's the thing. That's like, even as you say it out loud, my position is obviously unreasonable.
Your position is unreasonable, but I get where it's coming from. Because I also feel like in this same essay, like when they talk about the Ben Vereen story and how he was like trying to do blackface like as this homage and like to call out the Reagan administration and like all this stuff. But then they just ended up cutting all the stuff that gave it context. So it is sort of one of those things mm-hmm. where it's like, if you don't want to look like an asshole for doing blackface, you just shouldn't do it because it's going to yeah. be impossible to protect that it doesn't get interpreted in a certain way.
Yeah.
So I get that point.
I mean, that's yeah. the sort of the nature of comedy too, right?
Right?
Like intentions and time or intentions are just like trashed by time. I mean, I think to me the biggest example of this is like, or the biggest example that the most illustrative example of this that I know about is like current generations of Twitter children just know Blazing Saddles from a 2-second animated gif of Where the White Women At.
Like, I do not know Blazing Saddles at all.
Well, and well, you shouldn't. It's an old ass movie that has like, you know, good for the time takes on race. But the thing is, it's like all satire, it just starts, once it starts to fall apart, like the wheels are off of it.
Right.
And that is a little bit, though, it's like comedy isn't meant to be eternal.
Right.
Tastes change, points of view change, and it's like, okay. And that, again, not that we keep wallowing in the muck of fucking Dave Chappelle, right, but it's like, it's okay. It's okay for your shit not to be funny anymore. I mean, you know, ideally you don't become a huge fucking bigot. But
right.
Like,
it's okay for your stuff not to be funny anymore, but it's not okay for your new stuff to be racist, homophobic, or
yeah,
whatever. Like, if your old shit didn't age well, I guess we can get over it. Like, I watched some Jamie Foxx shit where I was like, after 9/11.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's so uncomfortable.
But you don't see Jamie Foxx out there being like, it's still perfect, I'm going to do even more of that stuff.
Yeah, of course not. Of course not. Okay, wait. Another essay. How did you feel about the essay about Black people in space?
I probably read that one slightly too superficially, but I was like, this feels dope to me, the Afrofuturism just kind of vibe. It also helps that our friend Tawny is, as far as current fiction goes, like the main Black person in space.
Right.
Or not main. I guess there's other like Star Trek people, but
she's like in space in multiple
person,
ways.
Black person in space.
She was like in space on the other space thing too. This one made me deeply emotional for whatever reason. I think part of it is because so Hanif's mother has passed away years ago when he was young, I think like 13 or so, give or take. And the aching love of a lost parent and the way he talks about his mom, like taking off her hijab when she comes home and her fro comes out. And like, my dad passed away almost 10 years ago. And that this essay just made me feel so many things. And like also the Trayvon Martin part of it about him being in space and having wanted to go to space and like that that's an aspirational thing and that this photo. And it just made me feel sad for Black people that like we don't get to be thought about as people who are in space. But also it made me feel thrilled that we actually are people who are in space and go to space. And like the bothness of this essay, and I'm also not a person who is interested at all in space or science fiction, and yet this essay made me feel like I deeply care about Black people being in space. And like, he has that line where he's like, there are codes to be switched even in sci-fi, which I thought, I don't know. I can't even articulate why I loved this one so much. And I don't remember loving it the first read, but this second read, I remember feeling like deeply, deeply, like I got teary almost reading this one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I wonder, I mean, it feels like almost like your experience is sort of as described in this essay, because it is like one of the reasons that, like, you know, the both like armchair psychology thing, or but also just generally like Black people have been excluded from the media of space for so long that it is like, space is for white people. Space is, you know, not where the future, and it's also right, of course, like because of science fiction, it is also sort of the dark implication of what the future, what happened in the future.
Right, right. And I think him writing earnestly about space, I think is maybe part of it too, of like, we should get to care about space. Like we should get to have public forums where we write essays about how great space is and our moms froze and little Black boys were murdered, and like that this essay has every right to exist. I don't know. I just love it.
Because it's
so much.
It's optimism. I think that's the thing, is like you have to be optimistic thinking about outer space and like going to, and that's like, and even as we are, you know, doing things like going into space more, like you can start to see that it is being segregated.
Right.
And it is like, you know, if it's this expensive and this like whatever, it, you know, we're in the time when maybe some of these things can change, but as it stands, like we are headed towards the sci-fi dystopia that looks like a utopia,
right?
Even in like, you know, fucking the Elon Musks of the world's brains,
right?
And it's like, right, like this is this essay and things like it are like how you begin the fight for that sort of like equality of the future,
right,
or representation, or just like, you know, not living in, you know,
yeah,
It is true. I think clearly did not like read it as like closely and as like
it just clicked for me in this read. But also because I think not only is there like a vision for us in the future and we're finally getting to talk about and write about space, but also that like we've always been in space, like talking about Michael Jackson and like the moonwalk and LaBelle and like their costumes and like all of that stuff. I don't know, for whatever reason, I just freaking loved this one. Besides Fear a Crown, were there other ones that really stuck out to you as like ones that you loved?
Yeah, the one about black punks.
Yes, that's Board Up the Doors.
Yeah, that's the one. So I think I may have mentioned this to you. I don't remember. But I immediately after finishing this, before we recorded, I was talking to a friend of mine who is a black punk, and I was like, you have to read this essay. Mm-hmm. Here, I'll give you my copy. And was literally about to hand him the copy that I needed to successfully or unsuccessfully, depending on how people are thinking I'm doing. But just to navigate this podcast at all, I need this book. And I was like, you have to read this. You will like this so much. But, you know, because I'm also a person who, you know, I grew up in the Midwest and like, engaged with a lot of this type of white culture, I think more like from an even less informed place, but like it wasn't until a little later that I was like, okay, these are really not my people. And that combined with aging a little bit, I think like really, really hit me pretty personally. I was like, right, this is both the age and the like not being able to be part of a community that you want to be in. I mean, I definitely saw that with like even like in comedy. It's like such a white space. Mm-hmm. And like finding my actual people as opposed to the people that I thought would be my people has been interesting. Like when I first moved to LA, I was writing scripts that were basically like clones of like Parks and Rec or The Office. And I was like, never got work from those. And it wasn't until I wrote something like much more autobiographical that I started like getting jobs, and I was like, right. I am who I am, and learning that took way too fucking long. But you know,
yeah,
I'm glad I'm there, I guess.
I wonder what you think about the Beyonce one, because when I was reading that one, I was like, I bet Andrew will have feelings about this. And it's similar. It's like being the only non-white person in a job. I mean, obviously this whole book is speaking to black experience, so we're sort of stretching the definition. But sure. She talks about like the performance of being the good black person at work. And it's, you know, it's like, I think the title of the essay is, let me find it. Beyonce performs at the Super Bowl and I think about all the jobs I've hated.
Oh yeah. Right.
And first of all, I just love thinking about Beyonce performing at the Super Bowl as a job, because I never would think that. But of course, it is very much her job. And she probably was like, the producer's so annoying. Like, they keep calling me about my costumes. I guess my question is sort of like, did you feel connected to this essay having been the only Chinese person or Asian person like in a workspace and like having like, you know.
That's, yeah. Oh, man. That's right. I think it's like I have, but I also want to sort of be cognizant of, you know, one of the main differences of the Asian American experience and the Black American experience is like our outrages tend to be less violent and less like, or sorry, not our outrages, but the things perpetrated upon us.
Right.
Like very generally speaking, please. You know, I understand there's lots of...
Yes, of course.
But very generally speaking, it's like, you know, young Asian men are, you know, significantly less likely to be gunned down for no reason,
sure,
et cetera. You know, extrapolate from that. So it is a thing. And there are, it's, you know, a lot... Well, again, I'm about to say something that is probably technically not correct. But it's easier for Asian people to sort of code switch and not even code switch, but just like be white adjacent.
Well, and there's an expectation around the stereotypes around Asian, especially East Asian, that like that you are belong in workspaces and that you're smart.
You're
and
one
like,
of the good ones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And hardworking, et cetera. And so there is a little bit of that. I mean, it's a little, not that it's, I guess, accepted or even as he talks about, in this essay, it's like when the sort of tragedies of the world or injustices of the world I mean, I guess I'm just going to speak about my experience, but like there is a little bit of triangulation about like how much like I can own of this sort of thing or how much is right for me to own. Mm-hmm. So there's sometimes a part of that where I'm just like, but I guess I understand the feeling, and I definitely have like, you know, as we've talked about, like had that feeling of just being like, fuck, right. Like, what are we going to do with today?
Right.
Like, is this like, and in any sensible place, there's a way of just like, this is a fucking mental health day. Like, right. You don't get it.
Well, he talks about how like the weapons are hidden in the small talk. And to me, that felt like so like the exact correct way to explain what it's like to be a Black woman in a white, predominantly white workspace. And, you know, I have to be honest, I was not sure if this was like the right book for us to do because you're not Black and it's a book about Black performance and whatever. And then I also thought like it's an interesting conversation to have with someone who performs with a Black person every week on the podcast, but also writes Black characters and like mm-hmm. writes into Black performance. And so ultimately I felt like this was actually a kind of an interesting way to approach this book because there's the understanding of what performance is from the observer. And then also, and what I think this book is more connected to is what the performers feel while performing the thing, which mm-hmm. I don't think we never ever take nearly as much time to think about, like the performer performing yeah. versus the audience receiving performance.
Well, and I think one nice thing about this book is like the way it kind of hops around to the personal and, mm-hmm. and of course like it's most notable in the I guess sections are called movements, and right. They all begin with "Times I've Forced Myself to Dance" essay, which that one, you know, it's very clear. Like this is about like everyone is a performer, but right. especially this lens is about how like the performance of like not performance of Blackness, but the way like Black people have to like perform in the sense of like you can't always say what you're thinking. You right. always have to be, you could have to conform to different things at different times within whiteness, within Blackness, within like, you know, how this book is, it is about how like relating to people who are not white or Black either as much, but it's all there. And that is the thing that the sort of like broad from the specific that I really, yeah, can talk about and really am hit hard by, is that like, okay, this is the face we put on today.
Right.
And this is, you know, this is the even more the all the world's a stage of it. Yeah, I guess that's a little bit my calibration is like sort of realizing that it is different for Black folks
right.
While relating to much of this.
Did this book change the way that you saw or understand the performance of Asian solidarity to Blackness in the last little bit?
So the reason I am probably one of the wronger people to ask about this question as far as Asian folks go is I think that's sort of definitely the main way I'm an outlier in Asian Hollywood. I am like, I would say, I guess people can correct me if they have a different opinion, but I feel like I'm like relatively hard on Asian people, especially for their anti-Blackness and like not owning it. I think the most prominent one I've talked about is like, you know, Awkwafina just mm-hmm. completely fumbling like her speaking in a Black set, as they say. Like, and it is a thing where it's like the current crop of young-ish Asian people, we really do not have a fluency or an experience with like a civil rights experience. Like we experience racism and some of us identify one way, but many of us are like able to shrug it off or sort of sublimate it. And partially it's because there isn't like the urgency of violence associated with the racism often. Again, I'm speaking very broadly here, but you know, and then a lot of us like don't really like think things through or just sort of internalize like the white point of view about like things that are like anti-Black in a relatively marginal way. And that's like also sort of combined with, you know, my parents' generation is just sort of not all of them, of course, but like, you know, the type of people sort of like my parents, like middle, upper middle class, like East Asian people, virulently anti-Black, like just like not even close to a type of solidarity. So, and then, you know, you see it in ways, other ways, I guess the opposite way, that's like, you know, the obvious clear versions are just like the Korean store owners in South LA and the animosity there. And, you know, I guess what I mean, I'm sort of meandering around the question.
It's okay. I wasn't sure. It's sort of like a really broad and sort of unfair question to ask you to speak on it. I just wasn't sure if like seeing, like, I don't know if this book changed my understanding of what it meant to be Black and like the performance of Blackness in a lot of ways. So I wasn't sure if it changed your understanding of what it means to be like in solidarity with Black people.
I think the way that it did change was like, I was a little like, because I kind of feel like I'm pretty fluent in like Black popular culture. And reading this really made me be like, wow, that was a huge overstep anytime I even remotely thought that.
Wait, I also felt that reading this book. And I was like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
But I think partially,
like, I don't know how to play spades. Sorry, I know.
I actually do know how to play spades.
I don't. I can play bones, but I don't know how to play spades. I know, like, dominoes, but not spades. And I'm not good at dominoes, so just, no, I don't like games.
We played a lot of spades in the mixed dish room. Mm. It was sort of, we did an episode. Finally, we were able to couch it as research, basically. Like, anytime, like, we didn't have something directly to do and the showrunners left, the fucking deck of cards came out and started playing spades. But I fucking love spades, I guess, is my point. I think it is like, I mean, but that's, as we said in the beginning, like, I think one of the things about this book is like, obviously this book is researched and like, it's not just like, but it's written in a way that he makes it sort of feel like if you're a Black person or you're, you know, think you know Black culture, you should be able to speak like this.
Right.
Which is like not true, but I think it's like sort of an inspiring goal.
It is inspiring. It's so inspiring. Okay, before we have to wrap up soon, but before we do, I cannot not talk about the Mary Clayton essay a little bit more. It was my favorite when I read it. It haunted me. I think about it almost every single day since I've read the book. I've been listening to the song at least weekly since I read the book. The idea that we're just a moment away, I think the quote that he says is, we're all just one moment away from someone else's lust for power. Hanif is such a good writer, and he really took a song that I like knew and liked fine and turned it into like a song that I feel like has been haunting me. And like Mary Clayton, and of all the essays in the book, for me, it was the one that just like jumped out and grabbed me by the throat and like did not let go. Like the story of her recording pregnant in the middle of the night with rollers in her hair and a fur, and she's balancing on a stool. And then we find out that that child died before it was born. And then like comparing it with the Meredith Hunter story in Altamont and like all of that, and then tying it into Mary Clayton now. It just, it like makes me feel like anxious trying to explain how great that essay is. Like, and
that essay is like super cinematic
too. Yes.
And I think what helps is that was when on my first read through I was like, okay, I have identified what's happening here and I will put the song on while I'm reading it. And so it just fucking grips you, like,
yes, oh my god,
very, very like, yeah, just dynamic and like heart pounding and like scary, pretty scary as far
terrifying.
as essays go.
Like, yeah, it's just like, it's unlike anything I've ever read in the sense that I was like, it like electrified me. Like when I think about, like, I feel like my heart rate is up just talking about it. And also having it be it comes right before the Beyoncé essay, which I just thought that was like such a stellar 1-2 punch. And when I reread it, it comes right after the Dawn Shirley Green Book essay. And the three of them together is just so insane. Like, to me, it is the supreme essay of the book. I know a lot of people like the Magical Negro one, the Ellen Armstrong. I know a lot of people really like the Spades one. But for me, it's the Mary Clayton one, like, well, just hands down.
I think it's also like, I think you sort of like identify, and maybe this was like, I wonder, but it is a little like, I wonder how intentional it is, but just by the way it's put to, this book is put together, you're like, it must be very intentional.
Yes, very intentional.
But the way the book like flows into that like sort of climactic mm-hmm. sequence mm-hmm. is just like shit. Yeah, because that probably also was like, it's like right around when I like really, really was getting how to read this book. And I think I probably read those all in one sitting.
Yeah.
Like in the evening with like a glass of wine. And I was like, shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's just like,
it was very intense.
Cause the book definitely has a flow to it where it's like, you sort of are like getting up into it. Then you get to this part where it like really hits its stride and you're just like, holy shit, holy shit. And then the way it sort of tapers out about like closeness, and it's like the essay on masculinity, the essay like on like love and masculinity, the essay on rage, and like it sort of kind of tapers out, because I think what it is that these middle essays are actually about performances, as opposed to mm-hmm. some of the other stuff is about the performance of grief, the performance of rage, and these are about like actual, I mean, they're about performances of other things, but they're also about performances mm-hmm. in a way that like we can understand. We're like so out of time, and I'm like devastated because there's so, like, we didn't even talk about the Whitney Houston stuff, which is incredible, and the Carlton stuff, and like the stuff about what it means to be white adjacent and like to be successful, which means white people love you, but to also feel like you're like that the people that you come from, in this case black people, like own you or like you're beholden to them. There's just so, I feel like, like, and like the idea of like acting white as an insult, like that essay is just so good too. They're just, I mean, they're just so good. Like even the ones I didn't like I think my least favorite one was The Beef Sometimes Begins with the Dance, which was like about New Jack City, a thing that I don't know anything about.
Sure.
That essay was like my least favorite. It did nothing for me.
I was really fascinated by the like the James Brown of it at the top of that one.
I did.
That was
like
very like, but like interesting. Yeah. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. The interest. Yeah. Think about I'm this. With you. Yeah.
But I think like I, on the like I was reading this wrong tip, I do feel like it, like it, because it's funny because like I, like they are clearly discrete essays, mm-hmm. but I think I just thought of it as like a wave. And so like, there's probably the ones that I like the least are the ones that I just like, you know, didn't process, but I just, like things I just didn't process because it was like taking on the whole thing. And it just felt like a fucking 4-day road trip with like, again, the smartest motherfucker you've ever met. And I was like, oh, right. I don't know anything.
I feel like I used to always ask people like, oh, do you think this book would make a good movie or a TV show? And I have to say that I think a TV show that delves into each of these essays as like different moments in black performance, like a mini series or whatever, mm-hmm. would be fucking incredible. And like getting to see like the footage and like,
yeah,
like a whole essay on like Whitney Houston and proximity to whiteness and like the time period and all of that. Like, I would just love it.
I'm loath to do this because I worry that this is not meant to sound as if it's diminishing it, but there's a version where like just an amped up audiobook of this
mm-hmm. could be incredible.
Is maybe the perfect reading, or like if he would just do like a live reading with like a you know, ability to run multimedia tape behind him or something like that. It's like, I feel like it's like so like good as it is. But then like, yeah, the ones where I was like, had the peace of mind to like just load the song and read it or
to be like,
you
ready.
Know, whatever. I was like, this is like fucking great. Like just as an experience. So I don't know what that would be. And again, I don't want to cheapen it by saying like, it should be a slideshow.
Right.
But like,
no, I feel you.
Part of me kind of thinks that would be very good.
Yeah. Okay. This is the last thing we do every episode. We have to do this. We talk about the title and the cover. The title is A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. And then the cover is all black with two dancers from the sort of first essay, the Soul Train / Dance Marathon. And you, it's the back of the man and they're in the air. And she's like got this look of sort of like surprised wonder. Like, can you believe we're doing it on it? And, you know, without being too obnoxious about my love for this book, I think that it's a perfect title, and I think that it is a perfect cover. Like, the picture mm-hmm. is perfect. I just, when I look at it, I feel things, I have thoughts. I love how dark, I love it.
It's nice because it's like dark and like a little high contrasty, but it is that thing where it's like, you know, I think obviously probably the larger world heard most about this when Moonlight came out, about like mm-hmm. cinematography mm-hmm. and like black skin specifically. And it is that thing where you're like, yes, this is like a photograph of black people, yeah. which is like not, you know, as photography is taught, it's not trivial to make that for like
right.
people who haven't thought about it as a specific skill.
Right. And it's like, you can't tell where the black of the background and yeah. the black of the people kind of begin and end. So it's sort of like, where does the performance start and what's just like being black?
Yeah.
And like, I just love. And the title is a Josephine Baker quote, which she gets a lot of play in the book, though. Again, the Josephine Baker stuff was probably my second least favorite. It didn't do it for me on both reads. But
I think like what really helped, not helped, but what maybe set me up on again, I definitely would understand if people, they shouldn't read it the way I read it. But the like subhead of like notes and praise of black performance did sort of set me down the path of like, okay, black performance, and like mm-hmm. understanding that that obviously is going to be broader than simply like a bunch of concert reviews
right.
or whatever
right.
it
right.
could have been with a similar title. And like, I think like that, as far as like the cover like leads into that flow, it's like, yeah, pretty awesome. And no, beyond grateful to you for both like, you know, letting me talk to you about this book, talk with you about this book, but also like just suggesting it in the first place.
Yay.
When I was like really looking for stuff to read that was like this. Like, this is like exactly the thing that I didn't quite know the specifics of what was missing from what I'd been reading, but like, this is beyond perfect for me on a personal level of like what I needed out of my reading habits.
I love that.
Or lack thereof.
That's a perfect
no,
place
thank you
to
so
end.
Much. Really, really wonderful.
Everybody, if you haven't read it yet and you've listened to the end, you must go read this book, A Little Devil in America. Mm-hmm. It's by Hanif Abdurraqib. He's great. Read everything he writes. Go follow him on Instagram and Twitter. He's just like so smart and interesting, obsessed with him. He also did an episode of The Stack. So if you haven't listened to that yet, it's from April, but I'll link to it in the show notes. Andrew, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This was really fun. And I said it 10 seconds ago, but truly, thank you so much for like getting me to read this book, introducing it to me. It was amazing.
Yay. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening. And thank you to Andrew for being our guest. The Stacks Book Club pick for January 2022 is Passing by Nella Larsen. We will be discussing this book on January 26th, and you can tune in next Wednesday, January 5th, to find out who our guest will be. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Our incredible editor is Christian Duenas. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. And our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.